Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present law professor Marjorie Cohen, who explains why she believes the Senate-White House compromise on detainee treatment is a disaster for human rights and the rule of law. Ian Williams, United Nations correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses international reaction to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's speech attacking President Bush at the United Nations. And Todd True, a staff attorney with Earth Justice, who examines the Bush administration's effort to overturn the prohibition on new roads in federal wilderness areas in western states. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In August 2005, health ministers from Africa and the World Health Organization declared a continent-wide emergency from the outbreak of tuberculosis. TB cases across Africa have exploded due to the spread of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. In 2004, nearly 600,000 people died of TB in Africa, a 10% increase from the year before, according to WHO data. Yet, the World Bank only spent 1% of its $2 billion Africa health budget on TB, reports the U.S. advocacy group Results International. As Stephen Lewis, the United Nations Special Envoy on AIDS in Africa, remarked, the World Bank is simply not pulling its weight. HIV and AIDS co-infection with TB is a nightmare in much of Africa, with co-infections rates 50, 60, 70% in patients. Results is calling for a massive health campaign on TB in Africa, similar to major initiatives against the contagious disease in China and India. The advocacy group is seeking upwards of $1 billion a year spent on TB and TB/AIDS programs in Africa. They are also looking for more engagement between world leaders and African heads of state to confront the growing TB epidemic. As Lucy Cheshire, a TB/HIV activist from Kenya, declared, if the World Bank is serious about development, TB must be a top priority, not an afterthought. In Mogadishu, Somalia, former militiaman Abdullahi Muhammad Noor has turned in his gun for the Quran. He now goes to a boot camp run by the ruling Conservative Council of Islamic Courts, which took control over Mogadishu in June from warlords. Noor was among hundreds of militiamen who ruled Mogadishu for nearly 15 years after the last centralized government in Somalia fell. Now, the ruling Islamic courts have restored order in Somalia's capital and reopened the ports. The Islamic regime has also moved to assert its control over the rest of Somalia, displacing the weak United Nations-recognized interim government. Militias loyal to the Islamic courts recently took over the port of Kismayo, Somalia's third-largest city. North of Mogadishu, 3,000 former gunmen now attend the Islamist rehabilitation camps. As Sheikh Mukhtar Robaw Ali, the Islamic Court security chief, told the Los Angeles Times, "We are rehabilitating their behavior, not their religion." Meanwhile, the UN-backed government, isolated in the city of Baidoa, struggles. Interim President Abdullahi Yusuf Ahmed survived a suicide attack that killed 11 people. The Baidoa government blamed Al-Qaeda for the attack. Reports of Ethiopian troops being deployed in Somalia to protect the UN-backed regime raised the prospect of a civil war between the Islamic courts and the interim government. The Islamic courts have repeatedly stated that the presence of Ethiopian troops in the country is a declaration of war. In a pre-election push, the Republican-dominated House of Representatives passed a new, stricter voter identification bill requiring voters to present a photo ID at the polls for the 2008 presidential election. Democrats and civil rights groups blasted the GOP measure as a 21st century poll tax. According to the Los Angeles Times, Republican-controlled state legislatures have passed tighter voter ID laws in recent years as part of a crackdown on immigration. In September, courts in Missouri and Georgia have overturned photo ID laws as violating the constitutional right to vote. On Capitol Hill, Michigan Republican Congressman Vernon Ellers, who sponsored the federal voter ID bill, says it was needed to stop increased fraud in voting in the U.S. Yet studies by the League of Women Voters shows little evidence of fraud at the polls. the American Civil Liberties Union only found 86 cases of convictions of voter fraud out of nearly 200 million votes cast since October 2002. In a Phoenix courtroom in late August, Navajo leader Leonard Gorman testified the 2004 law, Proposition 200, passed by Arizona voters, that requires proof of citizenship for voters, discriminates against Native Americans living in remote areas who don't often carry IDs. Meanwhile, a lawyer for the Republican National Committee has written the Arizona Secretary of State's office suggesting it should ignore the opinion of the U.S. Electoral Assistance Commission and require proof of citizenship for all newly registered voters. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
In a flurry of activity just 6 weeks before the midterm congressional election, Republican U.S. Senators McCain, Warner, and Graham negotiated a deal with President Bush to propose new legislation establishing acceptable interrogation techniques for terrorist suspects and the guidelines under which they could be tried in military commissions. The new measure was made necessary after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the president's previous rules governing military commissions, citing violations of the U.S. Constitution and the Geneva Convention protections for detainees. But according to civil liberties advocates, the compromise allows President Bush to issue his own interpretation of the Geneva Conventions by executive order and provides immunity to CIA and military personnel for past violations. The proposed law would also eliminate the right of detainees to challenge the legality of their detention through habeas corpus, a fundamental right guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. The case of Canadian citizen Mahar Arar is an example of such abuse. While returning home to Canada from a family vacation in 2002, Arar was detained, interrogated, and then sent to a torture cell in Syria by the Bush administration. He remained in prison under brutal conditions for 10 months before being released. The Canadian government recently issued a report finding that Mr. Arar had committed no crime. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, who explains why she believes the Senate-White House compromise on detainee treatment is a disaster for human rights and the rule of law.
Senators McCain, Warner, and Graham were ostensibly holding out for a more just piece of legislation, but this so-called compromise that they have struck with the White House actually has the most insidious and, I believe, unconstitutional provisions left intact. I think perhaps the most serious of which is the elimination of habeas corpus review for all non-U.S. citizen detainees. The Constitution is very clear that the only time that Congress can suspend habeas corpus is when there is a threat of rebellion or invasion, which we don't have. Nobody is rebelling or invading the U.S., or if there is a danger to public safety. And the enemy detainees at Guantanamo Bay, the alleged enemy detainees, were all picked up overseas, and they are in a very secure place in Guantanamo Bay, 90 miles from our shore. So they're not going anywhere. And as Senator Arlen Specter says and Senator Patrick Leahy, there is no justification. In fact, it's unconstitutional for Congress to suspend habeas corpus the way it has.
What about some of the other provisions that were negotiated, such as giving the president the right to determine what the Geneva Convention says, having him really make the definition himself?
That's a good point. Under our federal war crimes statute, which is a U.S. law, people can be prosecuted for war crimes, and war crimes have always, under that particular war crimes statute, which was enacted by a Republican Congress, by the way, war crimes have included violations of Common Article 3. Common Article 3, Bush had maintained, did not apply to our war with al-Qaeda. But the Supreme Court in the Hamdan case in June said, yes, indeed, it does. So what this so-called compromise between Bush and these three senators does is to narrow the scope of war crimes under our War Crimes Act. It's no longer all violations of Common Article 3, but rather just ones that have been listed in this new so-called compromise. And it excludes outrages upon personal dignity, that is humiliating and degrading treatment, which is, I think, what our CIA and much of our military actually does in Iraq, Guantanamo, and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And now that cannot be punished as a war crime. And the other part of Common Article 3 that has always been punishable as a war crime under our war crime statute, which this so-called compromise excludes as a war crime, is sentencing and execution of prisoners without a regularly constituted court with all the judicial guarantees recognized as indispensable by civilized people. That's the provision of Common Article 3 that the Hamdan case was all about. So what this does is to give the president, in this case Bush, the power to decide what, besides the listed violations, which are torture and murder and cruel treatment and rape, etc., can be punishable as war crimes. And, of course, he's not going to decide that any are because he doesn't want his people or himself under the doctrine of command responsibility prosecuted.
Specify for us, if you would, the immunity that this compromise legislation offers members of the CIA, the military, and the executive branch.
Well, it's retroactive, and it says no criminal liability for any of this. It goes back to September 11th. But it lets them off the hook. And, you know, one other thing that I should mention is that, you know how the government likes to talk about collateral damage when, you know, hundreds of civilians are killed in a military operation or there are allegations that our military has actually targeted civilians. Well, this particular so-called compromise actually says that collateral damage doesn't constitute a war crime.
Marjorie, in closing, I'd like to ask you this. What do you suppose the international reaction will be if Congress does indeed pass this new version of the detainee guidelines for terrorist suspects here in the United States? What will be the ripple effect internationally, do you think?
I think it will give tremendous ammunition to people in other countries who say that the United States government does not practice what it preaches. That it holds people indefinitely for the rest of their lives. They can't go into a court. The government is all powerful. It's like a dictatorship. And they can be mistreated and humiliated and degraded, and yet there's no relief. I think it's going to hurt us in this war on terror that Bush says he's fighting. The National Intelligence Estimate has already come out and said that the war in Iraq has really hurt us in the war on terror, made us much less safe, turned it into a bastion of terrorism. And I think this is just going to add more fuel to the fire, and people are going to point out the hypocrisy on behalf of the U.S. government. And it could also backfire when our soldiers are captured by other countries, and they'll say, look, the U.S., look at how they treat their prisoners. We're not going to treat Americans humanely either. And I think it's going to hurt us all the way around. And the only people it's going to protect are the interrogators, the CIA officials, and Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld and company.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the National Lawyers Guild at area code 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. In a speech like few others delivered at the United Nations, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez forcefully attacked President Bush and U.S. policies around the world. American TV and newspapers provided saturation coverage of Chavez's reference to Mr. Bush as the devil, while ignoring major points made during the populist Latin American leader's address. Democratic Party House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Representative Charles Rangel joined Republican politicians and conservative pundits in condemning Chavez for disrespecting the U.S. president. But U.N. delegates boisterously applauded Chavez's speech, which included denouncing the U.S.-supported Israeli war against Lebanon, calls for an end to what he described as the anti-democratic veto power held by five nations in the U.N. Security Council, and exposing Washington's double standard and support for right-wing terrorists in Latin America. Chavez also repeated his assertion that President Bush had supported an unsuccessful military coup against his government in 2002. The war of words at the United Nations momentarily overshadowed the U.S. conflict with Iran and highlighted Venezuela's current efforts to win a non-permanent seat on the U.N. Security Council, a bid vigorously opposed by the White House. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ian Williams, U.N. correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses international reaction to Chavez's speech.
Well, I think his language about the devil and the sulfurousness, the smell of sulfur in the hall, might have been a little over the top. But he wasn't trying to address an American audience. He knows that whatever happens, the Fox press and the Murdoch press, or the Fox and the Murdoch aren't going to give him any legroom, nor is any of the rest of the media, since they seem to follow the administration's cue on this. So to some extent, that detracted from the truth to power bit from the rest of the speech. But he's not playing to the U.S. press. He's playing to the third world. He's playing to the mass of people out there, and they loved every moment of it, if the reaction of the delegates is anything to go by. But the false indignation, I mean, these people have been calling for his overthrow. They've financed coups. They've made him honorary part of the Axis of Evil. They arrested his foreign minister at the airport. They kept half of his entourage on the plane and refused to let them off. And then they wonder that he actually shouts back at them. This is sort of stunning. This animal is dangerous. When attacked, it fights back. Neither he nor Ahmadinejad is attempting to speak to the American media, luckily. What they're speaking to is a huge audience out in the developing world, and there, of course, they were playing to the gallery and winning big applause. And whereas Bush's speech was so patently in orbit and out of touch with reality, you could you really have to wonder who wrote it for him, what planet they were on.
Venezuela has hopes of gaining a temporary seat on the UN Security Council. Do you think overall Chavez's speech and his blunt talk against the Bush administration will help or hurt his chances to get that seat in the contest between the U.S.-backed government of Guatemala against Venezuela?
I'm not sure. I think he sort of gains as many votes as he loses on it, because he didn't exactly observe the protocols, but it was quite clear from the applause in the hall that a lot of people were delighted with what he said and did. Once again, playing to the gallery, and the gallery, for once, actually votes here. When in a contested election, the whole membership of the General Assembly votes by secret ballot. So it has happened before that the United States has opposed people, and it has ricocheted on them. You know, the U.S. actually, one year under Madeleine Albright, never mind John Bolton, lost a seat on the Human Rights Council because people were so were so disgruntled with being hectored and lectured by the U.S. that even America's best friends took the opportunity of the secret ballot to vote against.
There were many commentators in the United States after the Chavez speech that said Chavez's blunt words against Bush will help President Bush and the Republicans in their run-up to this midterm congressional election. And, of course, you had Democratic Party Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Charles Rangel of New York, both in Congress, attacking Chavez, basically trying to distance themselves from the Venezuelan leader. What, if any, impact do you think this will have on election year politics?
I don't think it'll have too much. I don't think that the administration has actually succeeded yet in sort of demonizing Chavez to the extent that they have with Castro and the others. They're trying very hard. And, you know, we keep forgetting this guy has been elected several times, is almost certain to be elected next time. All the polls show he's intensely popular in Venezuela, so he isn't. You know, frankly, I think he does himself discredit by going so close to some unelected dictators in there. He would be much better off standing up on his own and standing up with Lula and the other Latin American people who've been elected. He's different. You might disagree, and you might worry that he's got some sort of strongman tendencies, but at the moment he's elected, and he's been reelected consistently.
You think the UN is headed for different times after Kofi Annan? Do you think there'll be a different tone there after he leaves? And who do you think will succeed him?
It's almost impossible to say at the moment. The US will oppose almost any decent candidate, but the candidates are, most of them, they're sort of forced by their circumstances. They can't bow down to what America wants and have any integrity for themselves or the organization. So no matter who's put in, and we must remember that Kofi Annan was an American nomination. But in the end, he was a principled person who had to stand for principles. And when America went wrong, he said so, even though he's done his best to engage both America and Israel in the process over the last 10 years.
That was Ian Williams, author of United Nations for Beginners, published by Writers and Readers. Read his articles on the United Nations in the pages of The Nation magazine and online at www.thenation.com. In January of 2001, just before leaving office, President Bill Clinton instituted the so-called Roadless Rule to protect 58.5 million acres of federal wilderness areas in the West from development. The Bush administration has been working to overturn the rule ever since so that roads could be built and extractive industries, timber, oil, and gas, can extend their reach into these remote areas. Last year, the White House rescinded the old rule but put a less restrictive one in its place, in which governors of western states have much more control over the use of these almost 60 million acres. But a coalition of 20 environmental groups, both local and national, sued the Bush administration, as did four western states. They were supported by a million citizens who submitted comments in favor of the roadless rule. And last week, a federal district judge in California overturned the Bush regulation, saying the Forest Service had not followed its own regulations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Todd True, a staff attorney with Earth Justice, which represents the Environmental Coalition. He talks about the importance of this ruling, which may or may not be appealed by the Bush administration to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
The federal government actually has not really done anything so far in terms of appealing the ruling or taking steps like that. They have said to the judge in California that they believe her decision only applies going forward and that there are some road building or other activities in roadless areas that had been approved that they think should proceed. Now, we were in court with the judge arguing that her decision should apply to all of the activities that would be prohibited by this 2001 rule, and we've got some further briefing to go there, and she will presumably make a decision about exactly how her ruling is going to apply to projects that the Bush administration allowed to go forward while it was in the process of repealing this rule.
Any idea how many projects that is or how many miles?
The number of projects are in the low two digits. They're scattered around the West, and probably some of the larger scale ones involve leasing of undeveloped roadless lands for oil and gas development. Those are probably some of the more significant ones that you'll be looking at.
Todd True, what Bush wanted was that the governors of these Western states would have more of a say than the federal government. That seems more democratic in a way. What's wrong with that?
They did have a say, and they did comment on this rule. What the thing about these areas that is unique is that they are national forests. They are not state forests, and so people in New York have an interest in and a legitimate concern about how the wilderness in the West is managed. And more importantly, perhaps, or as importantly, over the last three or four decades, what the Forest Service said it had discovered is that if you leave management of these special areas to sort of a case-by-case national forest or state-by-state decision-making process, they will get whittled away bit by bit because no one is looking at that bigger picture. And when they looked at that bigger picture, they said, you know, we've got, for example, 386,000 miles of logging roads on our national forests already. We can't take care of the environmental problems those roads are causing, and we need to protect the places that don't have roads across them at a national level because they're a unique resource.
What about the impact on endangered species if the bush plan were put in place? Didn't the judge mention that in her ruling also?
It's a similar point. If these areas are managed sort of piece by piece, then the ecosystems that support some of our endangered species, whether they're big ones like grizzly bear or fish like salmon, the ecosystems that support those species are going to be eroded, and these roadless areas are really important sort of reservoirs, savings accounts for those species because they're the last places that haven't been logged and eroded and where the water is clean and pure and it's great for salmon spawning or where the hand of man is not so visible and grizzly bears can roam across the kinds of areas that they need to survive. So, yes, the concern was that returning these areas to sort of management by different states at different levels at different in different ways would actually cause problems for a lot of these species. The court didn't say you can't have some flexibility in your rules or anything like that. It just said the wholesale repeal of this rule by the Bush administration, this rule that protected these areas, didn't follow the law.
What role, if any, did the conservative groups in the West play that were part of the Sagebrush Rebellion in the 1980s, which tried to roll back environmental protections?
Well, there were a number of lawsuits filed against the original rule to protect these areas, some of them by different industry groups, coalitions of off-road vehicle users or the timber industry or the mining interests. And so they apparently did not, from their economic perspective, like this rule, even though, as I say, well over a million individuals around the country wrote in and commented that this rule is really what's needed to protect these lands. Whether they have more or less clout today, I don't know, but it's certainly true that the Bush administration has been busy trying to reopen the public lands to exploitation by oil and gas interests and other folks who are interested in resource extraction and not in balanced stewardship of these lands.
That was Todd True, an attorney with Earth Justice. Contact the group by calling area code 510-550-6700 or visit their website at www.earthjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Phil Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.